Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We often have shows on American Variety on animals in various ways because most of us love animals, one kind or another, or several kinds or another. Today is one of those days. My guests are two people joining me from Raleigh, North Carolina. Dr. Christy Mazzacchio is a veterinarian, and Dr. Penny Jeffrey is the Education Program Director of a research center at North Carolina State University. They're both involved in an activity that's the subject of our show today, which is pig rescue, specifically the miniature pot-bellied pigs that are not actually used as the other white meat, but that are kept as pets. No laughter now. So the organization, just to kind of run that by you, is called Pig Pals of North Carolina, and it's a rescue organization for these pet miniature pigs. Penny is the founder and executive director who runs it, and Dr. Mazzacchio is a pot-bellied pig specialist who, I guess, donates your time operating a mobile veterinary service, Christy, that caters to pot-bellied pigs, right?
I do.
And so in your spare time, I think, to actually earn a living, you're a veterinary toxicologic pathologist, right? A very high-tech veterinary activity and function. But you're the veterinary advisor for something called the North American Pot-bellied Pig Association, or NAPA. So it seems to me, just to wrap up this little preamble, that I first started hearing about pot-bellied pigs in, I don't know, maybe the late 70s or so. How and when did they get to this country, either one of you?
So actually, the miniature pigs that we commonly know of here in the United States were brought forth from exotic shows to Canada by a gentleman named Keith Connell, and he brought more of the what we know as the Vietnamese pot-bellied pig, and it was in the late 80s that they were brought over and or to the California area, and then from California it swooped across to the East Coast during the 80s. So they really have only been here about 30 years in the United States, which is pretty amazing if you think about a short amount of time.
Yeah. They spread faster than coyotes.
They breed just as quickly.
I mean, it's hard not to make a few jokes, but it is a serious subject. So were they a food animal in Vietnam where they came from, or were they used as pets there?
Yes, of course. Hmm. Yeah, of course. Yeah. Definitely a food animal, but, you know, like many people in the United States see horses and goats and so forth, they begin to look at them as pets, and that's what's happened here in the United States. The majority of people that have miniature pigs see them as their pets and not food consumption.
Well, Christy, are they a distinct species from the domesticated pig? Are they very different from that pig?
Species, they are all the same. Porcine is just pig, and it refers to all the different breeds. So it'd be similar to all dogs, you know, or all canines, but they're different breeds within that.
Different breeds, yeah. So what do they look like? I mean, in general, you know, we all know what the classic Porky the Pig or the Barnyard Pig looks like. Do they look much different from that at all, or just a miniature version thereof?
When the miniature pigs were brought over here, there were three specific lines. There was a Polish line that brought in a white color variation, as well as an Oriental line that kind of brought in the white and black, and the Vietnamese pigs were predominantly black. And what we've had over time from breeders that kind of intermingled these. So what we get is a variation of color now from anywhere where we have almost a gray pig, gray-colored hair, all the way to the solid black pig, and then, you know, in between black and white. But in general, they all have similar characteristics. So they've got more of a short snout. They've got small, erect ears. They tend to have more jowls than you would see with a commercial pig. And they have this round pot belly and a straight tail, not a curly tail, what you see with the commercial-type breed. The end of their tail is usually a nice little cute tuft of hair.
Really? Not like a poodle, though.
No, more straight.
Well, I mean, are they proportioned like a pig, or are they kind of dwarf-like looking where they're a little bit disproportionate?
You know, the saying a miniature pig means it's about one-tenth the size of a commercial hog. And if you've ever seen a full-grown commercial hog, you know they can be, you know, 1,000, 1,200, up to 1,500 pounds or so. And so we're looking at one-tenth the size of that. So the national average is ounce for these animals, just like taking their commercial, you know, cousins and having them smaller.
And the looks can be slightly different since most of the miniature pig pets in the U.S. right now are essentially mutts. They're mixtures of various miniature breeds. There's a common misconception with larger miniature pigs that they are bred with a commercial breed and or a mixture of a commercial breed and a miniature breed, but that's rare, if it's ever occurred. It's just a misconception because the miniature pigs can range from 50, 60 pounds up to almost 400 pounds depending on the combination that went into that animal. And just like dogs, although there's a stereotype that people think of, the Vietnamese pot-bellied pig that Penny described with the short legs and the pot belly, which is a definite different conformation than a commercial pig.
Mm-hmm.
You also have miniature pigs that have longer legs, they're leaner, they have a long snout, and they tend to be a combination that includes some of the feral breeds we have in the U.S., and it gives them a slightly different conformation that more closely resembles the feral breeds than the commercial hogs.
Yeah, okay. So there's not really just one thing. They kind of range in a spectrum all the way up to basically smaller normal pigs. But were they originally bred down from a large standard-sized pig to this, or did they start off small and the big pigs were bred up? I don't know how that worked.
They are completely different breeds. The commercial breeds are the large breeds, and that's genetically how they're composed. The miniature pigs, the lines Penny talked about coming from other countries,
mm-hmm.
they are naturally feral, small pigs, genetically determined, and those breeds that were brought here were small genetically. They didn't breed them to a certain size. And some of the combinations led to smaller sized pigs, but it was still part of the genetics. Nobody has bred some little tiny chihuahua sized pig, which is a common claim, but not true.
Not been done.
Petite bacon. I'm sorry. Penny, you said that they've spread across the U.S. How many of them are there in the U.S. now?
You know what? I mean, we can't even get a count. I mean, there's definitely thousands of them. Predominantly what we see is larger populations throughout California, along the East Coast, you know, definitely too in Michigan and the upper states. But when we look at Florida and Texas, they are just, they're rampant in Florida and Texas. One of the problems is that people will just kind of dump their miniature pig if they no longer want them. And there's a huge feral pig population in those areas. And so there is some interbreeding that's going on. And, you know, the reproductive capability of pigs is just monstrous. So you can get large numbers in a very short period of time.
Sure.
Yeah, I have a couple hundred patients, just me alone in a part-time practice.
Yeah.
I serve a couple different states, and that's a really small area of the U.S.
Well, it's interesting. It sounds like it's more around the coast. I would have thought it was pretty much in the southeast. So that's a little different that it's California and the East Coast and Florida and Texas more than anywhere else.
Well, yeah, and they were considered to be fad pets, you know, when they first started. I mean, they would pay tens of thousands of dollars for a miniature pig in the late 80s. And, again, these were people, you know, East Coast, West Coast, California, you know, New York area and so forth. So that's changed a lot, though, over the years.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Dr. Christy Mazzacchio, who's a veterinarian, and Dr. Penny Jeffrey, who runs a miniature pig or a pot-bellied pig rescue organization in North Carolina. Penny, is your rescue league part of a larger national one? Is there a big network of these things?
There's actually a network of rescuers. We all work independently. However, there is a national pig organization called NAPA, the North American Pot-bellied Pig Association, that does have kind of efforts with helping out these individual state-owned rescue groups or state rescue groups. We are very much throughout most of the states in the U.S., but we are very independent from each other and kind of our mission and our goals of our rescue.
So exactly what does Pig Pals do?
So we are a 501c3 nonprofit organization that does rescue and placement of miniature pigs as well as educational outreach activities to make sure everybody clearly understands the true nature of this species.
As with dogs and cats, there must be a lot of reasons that miniature pet pigs end up needing rescue, but what are some of the most predominant ones and are they different from the situation with dogs and cats?
Very similar. However, the main reason that we're seeing owners that can no longer keep their pigs is because of size. So they get it from a breeder that did not represent the full-grown size of the pig accurately. It's grown larger than what they told it was going to be. And for whatever reason now, they feel that that larger size pig will not fit into their family. Another reason, of course, is economics. They've, you know, lost their job or had some other reason or need to relocate, and so they can't keep their pig. And then another reason, too, is because they were told it would be okay to get a single pig, and actually that's probably one of the worst things that you can do. You really need to have at least two pigs, egg aggression, in their household. And so that pig now begins to attack the family members, including the children, which can be dangerous. And so they, you know, they feel they need to forfeit the animal because of that.
You called it single pig
aggression.
Aggression.
Single pig aggression. Oh. Like, rawr, mean pig.
Are there also subdivision restrictions and, you know, neighborhood rules? I mean, are there laws that people run into where when they have one pig, people kind of turn a blind eye to it, but then when they have five or six or seven, suddenly it becomes a problem with their community?
Yeah, zoning actually is a pretty interesting issue because zoning laws differ within each state. And as well as then you look at the county and the city municipalities and so forth. And so, you know, pigs may be allowed in somewhere like the city of Raleigh. However, you go right down the road to a local, you know, town next door named Garner, and, you know, they may not be allowed there. They are considered livestock by particularly North Carolina Department of Agriculture, but that could be different in every state, their classifications.
Christy, what illnesses and other kinds of problems are they prone to? What are some of the main ones?
Pretty good stoic animals. Earlier, it would be a problem. People are often ignorant about what to feed them, or it's not even for lack of trying. They will go on the internet, which has some reputable websites, but also a whole lot of misinformation. Sometimes they're even told by veterinarians incorrect nutrition. And the general image in people's heads of what a pig should look like is chubby cheeks, even when you look at artwork depicting pigs. Most of the art out there shows fat, overweight pigs. So people purposely feed to a body condition that is way beyond healthy. So obesity is a big problem. Arthritis is another major problem as we get into the geriatric population. It's probably the number one reason that an older pet has to be euthanized. Eventually, just like humans, they take the same drugs for arthritis and it can help them with the pain for a while, but eventually you could put a human in a wheelchair but not an option for a pig, so they get to the point where they can't even stand up to eat anymore, and euthanasia is the humane option at that point. A few infectious diseases that can be controlled with vaccination and just appropriate veterinary care. They need to see the vet once a year, just like a dog or a cat. And then Bippity Pig, which is a very interesting name. It doesn't have a true scientific name because we're not sure what it is. It was given by owners, and it's this situation where they call frantically, and the pig has started to dip into a sitting position, screaming loudly, and then gets these oozing blisters down the back. And they usually suspect that the dog attacked them, he got run over by the car, struck by lightning, who knows. It's genetic, and it resolves in about 24 hours. It's very painful, but it just goes away. And we've tried different treatments, we've tried to figure out what it is, but it's a unique and interesting condition with a pretty funny name.
It's called Dippity, did you say?
Dippity Pig, yes.
Dippity Pig. Oh. So, I mean, is it possible it's an allergy or kind of a rosacea type of thing? Or?
It doesn't seem to be.
Huh.
It seems to be linked to the genetics of the pig, and it's usually the result of some stress, first visit to the vet, the introduction of a new pig, or the introduction of a new baby to the house, or transport, anything like that that they're very regimented in their daily lives, and anything that changes that can stress them out, can bring on this Dippity Pig. But they usually outgrow it. After about 2 years of age, they stop having episodes in most cases, and that's the end of it. And then, of course, there's things like hoof overgrowth, which they do need regular hoof care. Most people have the impression that, like a lot of animals, especially since these are only recently domesticated, that their hooves should wear naturally, that you shouldn't have to trim them. And that's definitely not the case. They can get feet to the point where they are unable to walk, and it also, since they're predisposed to arthritis anyway, will cause them to develop arthritis at an earlier age. So hoof trims are important, usually at least once a year.
Well, and tusk growth is interesting because the males will continually grow their tusks throughout their lives, but the females, you know, don't. They don't. The female tusks very rarely protrude out of the mouth. We've actually done some rescues with males that haven't had their tusk grown, and they grew so long that it punctured through their cheeks. The tusk sat in their mouth like a horse bit would. As you can imagine, that is going to be extremely painful. And so, you know, Dr. Christie will sedate them and we'll actually remove the tusk out through the cheek. And then, you know, we'll take care of them and make sure their tusks are always trimmed.
All right. So we've been talking about these animals as pets. And I assume then that they are house pets, right? They're not just kept out in the backyard, right? I mean, they're kept in the house for the most part.
Sure, I would recommend that, actually. Our organization doesn't recommend them too much as house pets.
Okay.
There is a way, of course, that you can have them as indoor-outdoor so that they spend a lot of their time outside. Remember, these are pigs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we can't humanize them to the point or, you know, have them like a cat stay in the house 24/7. They need to get outside and explore and root in the ground. And, you know, they love just laying in the sun during the day. But giving them the ability to come in and out through something like a doggy door is a great thing for them. Again, you want them to come into a part of your house where you don't mind that there might be dirt from the snout, you know, or dirt on their hooves. You know, Dr. Christie has a wonderful setup where they come into one part of the house that's theirs and they can get it dirty and, you know, you clean it. Just have a pig 24/7 in a house, I think, is inhumane for them. It's just not their most ideal mental setup.
Okay.
It also comes as a reason that they end up being forfeited because...
Wait, let me guess. They're not housebroken.
No, they are.
Okay.
No, they are easy and housebroken.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah,
okay.
Very easy. Clean animals.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Extremely clean, and after I housebroke my first pig, he housebroke the rest of my pigs. I had 10 at one point, and it was like having a bunch of cats. I literally did nothing but train the very first one. They are that smart.
Where do they go? I mean, do they go in the house, or do they go out and do their business outside?
They can learn to use a litter box, but outside is the best. And my pigs have a doggy door, and they go in and out as whenever they choose, and they use the bathroom outside, and they usually are fastidious and tend to pick a certain part of the yard to use the bathroom. If they have an option, pigs will choose to have a sleeping area, an eating area, and a separate bathroom. Commercial pigs don't have that option because they're group housed in small pens, which is, I think, where the misconception that pigs are dirty came from. But if they have it, animals you'll ever come across, and they're also really nice because they have true hair, which most of our pets have fur. So they don't shed in the same way that dogs and cats do, and they don't have the dander that causes allergies in most people. So they're a little different that way.
What do they eat?
Everything. They're omnivores. I mean, they're just like us. They are. In our sanctuary, we choose to feed them, you know, a vegetarian-based diet that is pretty much just like horse food. I mean, it meets all their nutritional requirements, but it's in a grain form. And, you know, most of the average for adult pigs is about 1 8-ounce cup of food twice a day. In general, that's what they can sustain from. Now, if you think about, you know, people that equate food with love, getting a pig probably is not the best situation for them because they can get obese very quickly.
The phrase eats like a pig has a very sound basis.
Yes.
They don't have an off button, and they're not one of the species that you can give free choice food to or just choose whatever you want and feed them as a garbage disposal. I mean, that's how hogs are fed.
Right.
Just left over anything, and you don't want to feed a miniature pig that way because that's how the obesity happens. They, in the wild, they forage 80% of the day sometimes just to maintain their body weight. So if their genetics are built to keep calories, to, you know, minimal calorie and maintain a good body condition, that means having excess calories is just going to put weight on them in a heartbeat.
I've always heard that pigs are, let's see, if you have the hierarchy of intelligence, then presumably the humans are at the top, although that may be shaking nowadays. But then there may be dolphins and then maybe pigs coming right after that. I mean, that they're very smart, in other words. Do you find that to be the case with the pot-bellied pigs or the little
ones?
Yeah,
so they are considered the fourth most intelligent mammal under humans. You have your primates and your whales and dolphins are
primates.
Together, and then pigs are considered that. They have an incredible ability to reason. So if you have a house pig and you go to the refrigerator maybe two or three times to give them their treat, they're going to start going to the refrigerator and demanding their treat.
Sure.
Actually, they learn to open the refrigerator.
Yes. Or if they do that, like, there's not an open refrigerator.
Oh, my gosh.
Same thing for cupboards. So yeah, when you have a pig in the house, you have to act like you have a two-year-old toddler and lock the doors.
Well, at least they're miniature. They can't reach the upper cupboards unless they jump up on the counter or something.
That's true, right.
So they use their snout-like hands. Will they play with you? I mean, are they interactive with you the way that a dog might be?
You know, they're very cat-like, I think, in their nature. They'll kind of come up to you on their own terms, and then they'll leave when they're done with you. So, you know, going back to the famous Winston Churchill quote about, you know, pigs being the only animal to look a human, a man, you know, right at the level of him is pretty true. Because they will size you up. They're herd animals, and they will size you up and determine if you're going to be top pig in their herd or if you're going to be low pig. And if you're not able to be dominant over them, then they'll go ahead and they'll rule the roost.
And they don't play the way dogs play. I think people sort of have that perception and buy toys and think the pig is going to play fetch, and that's not true, but they have their own way of being very entertaining. One of the main ways of interacting, it's not actually play, but pigs like to have their bellies rubbed. And they will literally walk up to you exposing their belly so that you can scratch it, which is a phenomenon we've been trying to figure out behavior-wise, because exposing your belly in a prey species is a very vulnerable position. It's not something that you would think that they would do naturally. But it's a definite interaction with their owners or people they trust. And in the wild, the dominant pig will often lay down and the subordinates will come and root on that pig's belly. So
there you go.
So we're submissive and we don't even realize
there
it.
There you go.
Yeah.
They rule us and we don't even know it.
They figured out they've got slaves and they're going to go with it.
They are so right.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking about pigs, miniature pot-bellied pigs to be exact, with Dr. Christy Mazzacchio, a veterinarian, and Dr. Penny Jeffrey, who is the founder and executive director of the Pig Pals of North Carolina, a rescue organization. So maybe a question for Penny. With dogs, and I guess with cats too, but more you hear about it with dogs, there's the problem of puppy mills and backyard breeders that result in all kinds of problems for dogs and then ultimately for their owners. Is it the same with miniature pigs? Is there the same kind of disparity among good and bad breeders?
Yeah, exactly. We know and cherish our very good breeders, those breeders that will give accurate information and that will be available to people after they've purchased their pigs to help them, and then also take back the pig at that point, you know, if the owners can't keep them anymore. But we have recently, in the past few years, have been interacting with clients that have bought from really what we would call just unreputable breeders, breeders that are going to say that the pig's going to stay a certain weight that is just not realistic for that pig, telling them things such as, you know, they get along great with dogs, and, you know, most dog breeds are a natural predator to the pig and will attack and kill them at some point if they begin to have a problem together getting along. Yeah, and then this newest micro, mini, nano, or teacup pig craze, which is just, you know, another name that's being put on as a marketing tool for the miniature pigs that have been here in the U.S. for 30 years. So the backyard breeders that are not truthful to the breed are begin to pose a big problem for not just rescue organizations, private, but also, you know, county animal control agencies and so forth, too.
People are eating up the teacup pig craze.
So to
lately.
Speak.
It's been very popular, and there's been a exponential resurgence of people wanting pigs, buying pigs, and then giving them up last year or so.
Yeah, and it's so important for people to understand that miniature pigs are not full grown until they're 4 years of age, right around that time. And so, you know, if you're wanting to buy a pig and they have the mother and father available, even if that mother and father are, only, you know, not 4 years of age, you don't know what the size is going to be. So they can breed a pig as young as just, you know, 6 months old. and sell you the litter from them. And so that's what we're seeing with these unreputable breeders, is they're breeding young pigs, saying, well, here's the mother and father, this is how big they're going to be, but they're not full-grown pigs yet.
I don't think people realize that a commercial piglet that's going to be 800 pounds, they also fit in a teacup when they're born.
Or a big mug, anyway.
There's not a lot of pictures of those out there, but they do fit in a teacup.
So it sounds like, obviously, pigs are not for everyone, these miniature pigs. A question for either one of you. What kinds of people and homes do you recommend consider buying or adopting a pig?
So, you know, we kind of have our idea of what we see. People that might have a farm or some type of indoor-outdoor setting, some type of fenced area that is large enough to support a pig and, or excuse me, two pigs, and that it'll be protective against anything such as stray dogs. Young children we get really concerned about, and so we want to educate the parents to make sure that their children aren't unsupervised with a pig at any time. You know, there's a lot of red flags that come up with people that want to adopt, but our goal is to try to work through those red flags to make them truly understand what they're getting into. And if it's, you know, if they just don't quite get it, then, you know, they don't adopt from our organization because we are here for the pig.
Prospective owners also need to research a veterinarian in their area who is willing to see a pig. That's a huge issue. It's not taught in vet schools, and many veterinarians just don't want to deal with them because they're not familiar and they're afraid they'll do something wrong, or they just don't want to deal with
the
pig that it just doesn't fit in a dog and cat clinic, but doesn't quite fit in a large animal clinic either. So people often have a hard time finding a vet, and they need to research to make sure they have a vet before they have the pig.
Yeah, and the pig will live, 15, 18 years is kind of what we've been seeing with this animal. So they definitely want to have a long commitment into it. And spaying and neutering, you know, no pig leaves our organization without being spayed or neutered. And so that's very important for many medical and you know, psychological reasons for the pig.
Well, we just have less than a minute left.
Pig Pals of North Carolina is on Facebook at Pig Pals of NC. Pig Pals of NC.
I assume, Penny, that all of the steps in the process for adopting a pig are there, but if you can, in 20 seconds or so, just kind of very briefly, what do people need to do to get started to adopt a pig through your organization?
So we only adopt pigs here in North Carolina, but we have connections with most rescue organizations in every state. And if you're in North Carolina, you can visit our website. If you're in another state, please contact us, and we will refer you to a rescue group in your state.
Okay, everybody. Well, if that sounds attractive to you, a porky pet in your life, you can go to pigpals.com and contact Penny's organization and see what you can do. I'm sure there are plenty of attractive, adorable, deserving miniature pigs out there who are looking for a good home. Thanks to both of you, Christy and Penny, for being on with us in American Variety.
Thank you.
Oink, oink. There you go. I was waiting for that. And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.